So welcome everybody. It's nice to see a good turnout for tonight's Sangha gathering. So yeah, I suppose what I wanted to do was I wanted to share a couple of thoughts. And I've got two thoughts, or rather I've got thoughts along two connected themes. And the first of that is the Bodhisattva ideal. So I wanted to just start by riffing on the Bodhisattva ideal. In this context, in the context of our Sangha. And I suppose the first thing to relate is something in the nature of a sort of an anecdote, or for want of a better word, yeah, an anecdote. Somebody, an order member who has been at the centre for a very, very long time, or, you know, around for a very long time, said to me one time that when they first came to the Glasgow Buddhist Centre, they thought that, from what they picked up from the Glasgow Buddhist Centre, from the culture of the time, they thought that the Bodhisattva ideal was Buddhism. That was it. Buddhism was the Bodhisattva ideal, and the Bodhisattva ideal was Buddhism. And the reason they thought that was because that was the way in which the Dharma was taught, or rather that was the context in which the Dharma was taught and spoken about and explored. Yeah, and it wasn't actually until a while down the road that they realised that actually the Bodhisattva ideal is an emphasis, it's an aspect, it's the altruistic aspect of going for refuge, or it's an expression, maybe is a better way of saying it. It's an expression of the altruistic dimension of going for refuge, rather than the whole of the Dharma itself. But the reason that they thought that that was the Dharma was because that was what they came into contact with very, very strongly identified. And I just thought, well, that is amazing. That is interesting. And it shows that there was a strong emphasis at that time, which I think doesn't exist anywhere near as strongly between us now. But I found it very, very attractive. And the reason that came to mind is because at some point in the last period of time, in my role as chair, for want of a better word, in my role as chair, I thought, well, what do I want us to do? How do I want us to be as a community? And I thought, well, for me, I think emphasising, re-emphasising the Bodhisattva ideal is, in a way, what draws me. That's what wakes me up, what opens my heart. And it's a challenge, yeah? It's a challenge. So, but what is it? You know, what is this Bodhisattva ideal thing that I'm talking about? It starts with, I think, a passionate conviction. A passionate conviction that one's own happiness and one's own suffering is inextricably bound up with the happiness and well-being or the suffering of others. Yeah? So a passionate conviction that one's well-being is inextricably bound up with the well-being of others, and a complete identification within that, that what is good for oneself is good for the world. Yeah. And it's an identification with the desire for the growth of others. Yeah. And as I said, it's urgent. Yeah, it's not optional. So one hears, one is sensitive to the cries of the world. One is sensitive to the drug addiction. One is sensitive to the alcohol addiction. One is sensitive to the poverty. One is sensitive to the homelessness. One is sensitive to the ill health. One is sensitive to the poor mental health. One is sensitive to the lack of culture that we have. One is sensitive to the lack of moral philosophy that exists between us, really. And one's heart is urgently called or awakened by that suffering. Yeah. Now, I think that what we have between us is very, very good. And I don't have necessarily a problem with what we have between us. But I think that it's true to say that quite often our emphasis is in personal growth with an emphasis on the personal. And that's okay. I think we have an emphasis on self-development, and we big up with an emphasis on the self-development. And I do think that that is okay. And I do think that within that, there is an awareness that it's important to be less selfish. But I don't know if it's urgent to be less selfish. Yeah? And the thing about having a context of personal growth and self-development that honours and acknowledges the need to be less selfish and to be more other-regarding, I mean, you know, would that I lived by that, actually, you know? Would that I really fully lived by that, I would be a better person. But I think that there is just, for me, if I speak about myself only, I think there's a tendency to forget or to underemphasize the other regarding aspects of practice. Yeah. And it is possible to end up with, it would be possible for me, and I think it would be possible for many of us, to end up with a spiritual practice that was about the pursuit of a personal level of insight. What a shame. What a shame if we were in pursuit of a personal level of insight. Because there's something in that that's pseudo-spiritual as opposed to vitally alive, I think. And I'm speaking about myself. I'm really not criticising other people. I'm talking about myself as somebody deeply embedded in this culture. And I think that for myself, what I, you know, it's like I go back to that idea that you come to the Glasgow Buddhist Centre and you hear about the Bodhisattva ideal so explicitly that that's what you think, that's how you think, that's all you think the Buddha ever taught. And I think, wow, that's amazing. And I think that what is why I'm saying that if you ended up with a pursuit of insight for oneself, the reason I'm saying that that would be not a spiritual development but a pseudo-spiritual act is because I think there's self-clinging in that personal pursuit of insight. And it's there's a phrase that you hear in the Tibetan traditions which I absolutely love, self-cherishing. Yeah, so it's limited self-cherishing. So self-cherishing is not metta. It's not the first stage of the metta bhavana. Self-cherishing is when you erect a beautiful white picket fence around yourself. Yeah, and I suppose what I think of is the Dharma, the ocean of the Dharma, sweeps away those picket fences, sweeps away the picket fences that we erect between us. Yeah, and it's a process. You know, it's a process of learning to become aware. Mindfulness teaches us the barriers that we erect between ourselves, and metta gives us the courage to pull it up and throw it away. Yeah. And it's a process. Now, when we think about the Bodhisattva ideal, when we think about the arising of the bodhicitta, we think of that as being a development from the Mahayana, yeah. But it's not just that, you know. So it's deeply embedded in early Buddhism and in the way that the Buddha Shakyamuni taught. It's deeply embedded in the Pali Canon, and we had a women's order day here at the weekend, and Jayavardhani was introducing us to this great sutta from the Samyutta Nikaya called the Siddhaka Sutta, and it's about a master acrobat. He's a bamboo acrobat. There are two acrobat characters and the Buddha, And I think this is a great story because it shows you that what I'm talking about, going from self-cherishing to a passionate engagement with other people's well-being, is a process. And you get that in this sutta, I think. So you've got the master acrobat, the bamboo acrobat master, and his assistant, this young girl. And in the sutta, her name, she's called Medakatalika. Medakatalika. And if you translated that literally, it means frying pan. So you got frying pan and the bamboo acrobat. Fantastic. And so the master bamboo acrobat says, "My dear frying pan, let us look after each other. You go on my shoulders, I go up the bamboo pole, and you look after me, and I look after you. And in that way, we perform our act safely, and we get our reward, we get our money, and then we both get down safely from the pole." And Frying Pan says, "Oh, no, 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 it's not like that at all. It's not like that at all. I got on your shoulders, and you go up the pole, and I look after myself, and you look after yourself, and in that way we'll do our act safely, and we'll perform our act, and we'll be given a reward, and we'll come down safely. And that's how you, and that's how we're both okay." And so then the Buddha comes along, and the Buddha just is, you know, the Buddha is observing this, and what the Buddha does is he says, the Buddha says, "Just like the assistant Medakatalika said to her master, I will look after myself, so should you monks practice the establishment of mindfulness. And you should also practice the establishment of mindfulness by saying, I will look after others." So looking after oneself, one looks after others, and looking after others, one looks after oneself. And how does one look after others? By looking after oneself. By practicing mindfulness, by developing it, by doing it a lot. And how does one look after oneself? By looking after others. By patience, by non-harming, by loving kindness, by caring for others. Thus, looking after oneself, one looks after others. And looking after others, one looks after oneself. So I think this is more profound than just, oh, it's a bit of both. I think it's a lot more profound than this. If you read that and if you reflect on it, and then if you take it, if you identify where the rub is between one's looking after oneself and the knowledge that you could actually let go and respond more to other people. If you look at the real concrete bits of your life where you experience that as a dichotomy, it's possible for something to open up and for you to realize that actually there is a false distinction there. Yeah? If you reflect on it and if you bring metta to that experience of dichotomy, it's possible for a bigger something to come into being, and that bigger something is a realization that you've made a false premature distinction between what is good for oneself and what is looking after other. So I think that in a way what it is getting at here, this mindfulness of the completely provisional nature of self and other, it rests in the confidence. I think it rests in a deep confidence that looking out for other people's well-being gives rise to one's own happiness. Gives rise to happiness, yeah. Now, I don't know if you've ever had this experience that you're maybe doing the metta bhavana and you're not going on very well, right? And so you do the first stage and it's a bit flat and you can't access very much and it feels a bit goey through the moshy. So you think, and then somebody rings the bell and you think, oh no, just stay in the first stage. And then they ring the bell again. You go, no, I'm just going to be really good to myself. I'm just going to stay in the first stage. And you do that all the way through. And you come out at the end of the Met Bhavna and it's no better. And I don't know how often I hear people say that they don't get on very well in the Metta Bhavana, so they only ever do the first stage. And I think, actually, you're never going to get on in the Metta Bhavana if you stay in the first stage, because you've got to get out your own house, yeah? Because you get stuck, and you can't even see, you can't even access the deep level of habit and assumption that you make about you, you know? And that actually the way to kind of let the seed germinate is to take a risk and contemplate the other, you know, that's the way. And I find it interesting quite often when people tell me that they do that in the Metta Bhavana, I don't get all over them and go, oh no, don't do that. I think, oh well, okay, just good luck. Mm-hmm. See how it goes. But I think that actually it's just what you do is you buy into inadvertently continuing to create the same habits, assumptions, an assumption of self, yeah. So happiness comes from caring about something beyond yourself, yeah. Now there's one of the classic texts about the altruistic dimension of going for refuge is the Bodhicaryavatara. So this is what it says about happiness coming. Happiness comes from caring about something beyond the self. This is one of the opening passages of the Bodhicaryavatara. And it's dramatic. At night, in darkness thick with clouds, a lightning flash gives a moment's brightness. So sometime, by the power of the Buddha, the mind of the world might for a moment turn to acts of merit. This being so, the power of good is always weak, while the power of evil is vast and terrible. What other good could conquer that were there not the awakening mind? So in a way, what that's saying there is that in this sense of the mind of the world might for a moment turn to acts of merit. I suppose what that's saying is the way to get out of the enmeshed habit, the closed habit of self, is to think about how we can together effect change. Yeah, together. Rather than me individually on my bit and you over there on your bit. There's us, there's a we. Yeah, there's a collective, a collectivity. So for me, in a way, what I'm doing here in this talk, what are you saying, Daphne? What are you saying? What I'm doing is I'm outing the fact that I care about this, and I've kind of got to a point where I want to talk about it in the Sangha. I want to talk about how we practice on an altruistic level together, you know? And there's a particular, perhaps concrete realization or actualizing of that I'm also interested in, which I would like for us to talk about together. So as a way of us exploring the Bodhisattva ideal together, and when I say the Bodhisattva ideal, that maybe sounds a bit jargonized. What I mean is the way that how we address suffering in our city, yeah, how we address sharing the Dharma with our fellow beings. One of the ways that I'd like us, something that I'd like us to talk about, is I'd like us to talk about giving the Dharma away for free. That's what I'd like us to think about. So in this arising of the bodhicitta, in this ideal of the bodhisattva hero, the bodhisattva becomes the bodhisattva. You know this inside out. The bodhisattva becomes the bodhisattva by practicing the six perfections. So generosity, ethics, patience, energy, meditation, and wisdom. Now you'll notice that we've got six perfections. None of these perfections is kindness, yeah? Because kindness is the way, yeah? Kindness is not the object, yeah? The way that you proceed is through this is through mindfulness of your motivation, mindfulness of your motivation, kindness. So the first of those perfections, and you all, most of you know this, the first of these perfections is dana, is giving. And traditionally there are things that one gives. Material assistance, that's good, that's important. There are people out there, they don't have water that's clean. Yeah, they don't have clothes to put in their back. They're stuck in some ghastly factory. Get them out of the factory. Help them out into a job that's meaningful. So that's one. Material assistance. Time, energy and thought. So the people that you come up against, give them time, energy and thought. Knowledge. This is one of the givings as well. Knowledge. And so that's framed in terms of culture and education. So you know that thing about, give somebody some fish and they can have a meal, teach them to fish. And well, actually, it's a shame for the fish, isn't it? Let's plant crops. Okay. So we're giving material assistance, time and energy and knowledge. And then the next one is fearlessness. And what does that mean? It's confidence. It's confidence to talk about the Dharma. It's confidence. It's confidence to say that you think the Bodhisattva ideal is important. It's confidence, fearlessness to show yourself in a communication, to show that you're hurt, to show that you're full of doubt, to show that you don't know what to do next. Yeah, as well as to show your inspiration and your joy. Life and limb. I've got nothing to say about giving life and limb. I'm not that advanced. And the last one is the Dharma, so giving of the Dharma. And that one is called the supreme giving, the highest giving. So giving the Dharma, that's just in there up front. That's the major big cheese. And that's the tradition, is that you give the Dharma away. You give it away, you don't charge for it. We charge for it. So I'm interested in us talking about not doing that anymore. This, what is quite often called a dana economy. A dana economy is that you give what you can and you take what you need. Yeah? And it's as distinct from an exchange economy, where you're just looking after yourself and you're measuring out what you can get and what something is worth, what its monetary value is according to the Chancellor of the Exchequer, okay, and according to the Bank of England. And that's how you know what it's worth, you know? So a dana economy is completely different, because what you do is one agent just gives freely and doesn't expect a return, and the other agent receives. And that's what they do, they just receive. And some of us, and me included in this, find it difficult to receive. But also, in a dana economy, one of the things that you do is that if you do give completely voluntarily, you're not giving for yourself, yeah? You're giving on behalf of the people who will come after you, yeah? So it's not that you're looking after yourself. You're investing in future beneficiaries, recipients. Yeah? So you give for others. So that's the case at Dana Kosha at the moment. You make a booking fee, yeah? But when you go on retreat, that retreat is free, yeah? They will suggest some donations for you, and you can take the suggested donations, and you can take your cigarette lighter and you can set fire to them, and you can give whatever you want, and you don't have to give anything, but you don't give for yourself at that point. What you do, because your retreat is free, but you give for the next lot of people, or people in the future, and you don't know who they are, and you'll never know who they are, and that's quite beautiful, yeah, because it's not about you, yeah. Because the retreat centre has already been set up. You are on the receiving end of conditions that have already set up. So you're not shelling out your money in order to create that retreat. That's been created by the dana that was given months and years before. Yeah. So in a way, this is what I would like for us to think about doing together, is that we ask people that when they come here for a Buddhism course, for a meditation course, we give it to them for nothing. And we don't say, oh yeah, Buddhist meditation, there's a suggested donation of this. We say it's free. That's it. We say it's free. And then a bit later on we say, put something in the bowl if you like. Yeah. But that comes, you don't take the words charge and just flip it around and say suggested donation. You really mean that it's free. Yeah. So this thing about that you're not giving it for you, you're giving it for other recipients in the future, in other people who are going to come after you in the future, and you don't know who they are because they're strangers. They're all the third stage of the metta-bhavana at this point, these walk-ins. And you're saying that what's good for you is good for them. Yeah? And if it's meaningful to you, then it'll matter to them. Yeah? So straight away there, you're breaking down. You're breaking down what is distinctive and unique and isolated about you. And you're going, okay, it works for me, it works for them. Hurts them, hurts me, benefits them. Yeah? Okay. Now, if we go back to the Bodhicharyavatara, there's a section in that I'm really into at the moment. I kind of go in and out of relationship with the different chapters. And I had a month solitary earlier in the year. I could not go on with the wisdom chapter one little bit. It was all mince. My understanding had contracted and gotten quite small and tight, and I couldn't understand the wisdom chapter at all. Couldn't wait to get past it and onto the onto the dedication. It all gets happy again. But I really, really connected, and I think it's because I've been thinking about this. I really, really connected with the meditation chapter, and what that's about is it's about exchanging self and other. So I think it relates to this thing about, you know, what is meaningful to somebody out there will be meaningful to you. So I'm just going to read a couple of a few bits from The Perfection of Meditation. At first, one should meditate intently on the equality of oneself and others as follows. All equally experience suffering and happiness. I should look after them as I do myself, just as the body with its many parts, from division into hands and other limbs, should be protected as a single entity, so too should this entire world, which is divided, but also undivided in its nature, to suffer and be happy. Even though suffering in me does not cause distress in the bodies of others, I should nevertheless find their suffering intolerable because of the affection I have for myself. In the same way, though I cannot experience another's suffering in myself, his suffering is hard for him to bear because of his affection to himself. I should dispel the suffering of others because it is suffering like my own suffering. I should help others too because of their nature as beings, which is like my own being. So I've been thinking about this and I started talking to the other trustees around the centre about it. And I went and talked to my friend Surya Matty. She's the chair of the Sheffield Buddhist Centre. And for some years now, they've been running purely a dana economy. Absolutely. And again, they really do say this is free. Yeah. So I asked her what her experience was. And she talked a little bit about the benefits. And one of them is that she feels that it really helped her sangha, like her... the order and Mitra Sangha really feel that they had ownership of their centre, and they talked about it in terms of really taking your stake in the project. Yeah. I think a benefit for me is actually that it's traditionally Buddhist, not charging, and it puts you fully just in alignment with that intention. And I think, in a way, I think that that in itself must have some form of collective merit. But here's the thing as well. What they did in Sheffield was when they stopped charging for things, their numbers went up. And in sometimes their numbers even doubled. But the amount of money that they got was the same. But they didn't view that as a loss. They viewed it as a gain, because the Sangha is made of people, not money. You know? But one of the things that is a really strong, strong, tangible benefit for their Sangha is that when their Sangha grew quite substantially, one of the things that the way in which it grew was that a lot of young people came to the centre, because they realised that they were being sincerely invited, and they were students and they don't have a lot of money, and they've also got debt because they're students. But they heard that something was given freely, and they just responded. And that just brings a lot of energy and a creative edge of vitality in their Sangha. But it's quite a mixed Sangha, mixed in terms of ages, in that there are quite a lot of very well established, mature practitioners. So it's very balanced. And I think if we look around us, there's actually, this is probably like for the first time in donkey's ages that we could say that we've got maybe about three or four younger Buddhists in the room. Anyway. I think there is this sort of sense for me of being aligned to the tradition that I think is important. And the fact that actually just like loads more people went, oh, actually I could do that now. I could do that now. And that for me just means that those are people out there in that city who at the moment don't feel that they can really come through the door. That pains me. It's a barrier, you know. And it's not a nice white picket fence. It's a kind of something else, isn't it? It's a bit of armour. So anyway, I suppose what I would like to do is ask you if you're interested in talking about this and exploring it. Yeah? Yeah? I feel that it's a big change. And I only want to go there if I feel that we would go there together in a kind of grassroots way, that we wanted to, that we want, that that we were behind this as a change. So if enough of us feel let's explore this and look at taking it forward, we need to meet and we need to talk about it and we need to discuss it, so that we go there together. And I think it is important that if we do this and we stop charging, that we need to keep in touch with it. We need to keep in sight the bigger picture of the Bodhisattva ideal. Otherwise, it'll just lose meaning. Yeah, do you know? It'll just become a sort of another complacent habit. And in a way, I think everything is in danger of becoming a complacent habit unless you're aware of the opportunity within it. Yeah. So I'm, in a way, I've made my pitch. So I'm getting quite a lot of nods. That's nice. What I will do is I will look for an opportunity in which we can take it forward and actually dedicate a bit of time where we can just thrash it out between us and discuss. Yeah. I'm going to leave you with the transference of merit from the Bodhicharyavatara, because in a way that's what we do. If we make the Dharma accessible to more people, then the transference of merit isn't some kind of woolly idea. It's come in and try this out. So we're giving the opportunity, you know. So in a way, it's the if you can take the word merit. And it's that you're transferring the teaching, yeah, into the lives of other, you're offering it into the lives of other people. With the good acquired by doing all this as described, May I allay all the suffering of every living being. I am medicine for the sick. May I be both the doctor and their nurse until the sickness does not recur. May I avert the pain of hunger and thirst with showers of food and drink. May I become both drink and food in the intermediate aeons of famine. That's what we have, isn't it, out there, in here, aeons of famine. May I be an inexhaustible treasure for impoverished beings. May I wait upon them with various forms of offerings. See, I give up without regret my bodies, my pleasures, and my good acquired in all three times to accomplish good for every being. Abandonment of all is enlightenment, and enlightenment is my heart's goal. If I must give up everything, better it be given to sentient beings. I am the protector of the unprotected and the caravan leader for travellers. I have become the boat, the causeway, and the bridge for those who long to reach the further shore. May I be a light for those in need of light. May I be a bed for those in need of rest. May I be a servant for those in need of service for all embodied beings. For embodied beings, may I be the wish-fulfilling jewel, the pot of plenty, the spell that always works, the potent healing herb, the magical tree that grants every wish, and the milk cow that supplies all wants. Just as the earth and other elements are profitable in many ways to the immeasurable beings dwelling throughout space, so may I be sustenance of many kinds for the realm of beings throughout space until all have attained release. So that's what I want us to do.